MyMac Podcast number 110.
And it's our 110th podcast here at MyMac.com. Welcome to the show. Welcome, Chad Perry.
Hello, Tim. Hello, Guy.
And Guy, that's my cue.
That's
hi, everyone.
This week we're going to talk about a couple different things on our short segment here. The first thing we want to do is remind everybody of our podcast sponsor, and that's Small Dog Electronics. I talked about it last week. You know, if you've already got an iPod and you want to take it with you jogging or exercising or what have you, if it's a full-size iPod, that's probably not the best thing to take with you. I don't think, anyways. Do you?
No, I think something smaller.
Yeah. I think probably a Shuffle would work really well.
Oh, yeah.
Or I think a Nano actually would work best of all, because it's real easy to set up your playlists. And if you know that you're going to be out jogging for, say, a half hour, 45 minutes, you set up a playlist for exactly that amount of time and pick the songs that you like.
You know, I actually got to listen to one of the new Shuffles. The sound quality of them, wow, it's really good.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
Are they doing something different with the Shuffle than they are with the other iPods?
No, but I would say no, but there's something about the fidelity. It actually, I think it sounds a little bit better than a regular iPod.
Hmm.
Maybe it's simply the audio chip that they're using in that.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it sounded really, really good to me. So, something to keep in mind.
I had understood that they redesigned the earbuds when they came out with this last edition of iPods.
I used my own noise canceling headphones when I tested it. Not that the guy whose iPod Shuffle it was seemed to have dirty ears, but I don't know, if it's something you stick in your ear, I really don't want to stick.
Oh yeah,
it's like using someone else's Q-tip.
Well, yeah, you know? And if it feels like it. Like after you put the butt in, that it doesn't want to come back out, that's a good sign that you probably shouldn't use those earbuds again.
Or when you pull it out, you hear that's probably a bad thing.
Or a wet sound. That's not good either.
You know, those earbuds do come with those little cloth things that you could put over them.
Oh yeah.
I don't know anybody who uses those. Everybody I see using buds, they don't have the little cloth thing on there.
They don't stay on.
Well, every single time I've tried to use I've tried to use them with the cloth things on. You know, I'll be in the grocery store or whatever, and by the time I get done, when I put it all away, it's like, oh, crap, one of them's missing. You know, it's not in my ear. You know, God only knows what happened to it. So I think after a while, people just give up.
I think so, too. Or they sneeze really hard and it comes out. Oh, there it is. must have pushed it in a little hard last time.
I hate when that happens.
I do, too. So thank you, Small Dog Electronics, for sponsoring our podcast. And, you know, we've got a pretty big event in the Mac World coming up here in just, what, 3-4 weeks from now?
Yep, Mac World Expo.
I guess it's 5 weeks. 5 weeks from now, isn't it?
Yeah.
5 weeks. Mac World Expo.
Is that a big deal in the Mac side?
Well, for the iPod side of things, yeah.
Okay.
You know, I'm really looking. Do you have any specific plans of companies that you want to talk to, Guy, or are you just kind of free-flowing?
You know, I haven't been to a Mac World in so long. It's probably been like 2001, 2002, you know, the last New York show. Typically, when I went to them before, it was, you know, kid in a candy store kind of thing. I would just go running through the halls going, yeah! And, you know, I'd just look and see whatever was catching my eye at that particular moment. Plus, also, I'm looking for, you know, who's got the best swag.
But, you know, the truth be told, you weren't covering those events as press the last time either.
No, I was not.
So this will be a little bit different experience for it. Now, did you get your press pass yet?
I believe I have.
Okay, great.
It says mymac.com on it, and it calls me a podcaster.
Aha, so that must mean that
brilliant.
You're there. Brilliant.
Brilliant.
So,
yeah, fooled another group of people.
That's right. One of the things that we're going to do, now your brother is also tagging along as well, correct?
Yes, he is.
Which he has submitted something for MyMac.com to publish, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I've read most of it at this point. It's really long. It's like 25,000 words. So it's quite lengthy.
You might want to break it up.
Yeah, I may have to break that up just a little bit. But, you know, it's really, really good. And it's all about how he got into desktop publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes way back to the typewriter days when he was in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Xerox machines and his first Mac and... It's really a good read, and I'm trying to figure out how we're going to break that up.
Well, Larry doesn't like to talk about himself that much, but he is probably one of the smartest people that I know. I remember back when I was a kid, because he's about 7 years older than I am, they were doing, you know, those standardized IQ tests, and he tested at about 180.
That's when that's when you had to really know a lot about horses and buggy whips. And,
right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. He also skipped two grades.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Was that because he dropped out, or
the school burned down,
or he just
no? It's just, well, we are talking about Florida, so how hard is it to be smarter than most other people?
Well, that's a good point there.
Case in point.
So, anyways, one of the things that we're going to do some humorous video work while we're there. We're going to do some podcasting. Obviously, we're going to do a lot of podcasting. One of the problems that we have is how we're going to record the podcast. Now, obviously, we're not going to lug around the MacBook Pro with our super expensive mics and setup and guys' soundboard, and that's really not practical.
Yeah, that stuff will be back at the hotel waiting for us.
Right, under lock and key, in case there's people at the hotel listening going, ho-ho, swag.
Oh, podcasters.
So what we're looking to do, this was my idea. I have an older DV camcorder. It's a Canon D50.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a very nice boom mic on there. It can record in both stereo and shotgun.
Yep.
Shotgun means whatever's right in front of the mic is what it picks up the best. I was thinking of using that camcorder as our podcasting recording tool. It's small. It has a great mic on it. We could actually get external microphones to plug into it if we wanted to, but I think the boom mic would probably work best.
Mm.
This might be something that I have to test out before.
When you're talking about a boom mic, you're talking about putting a microphone
it
on
attaches,
an extension arm and like hanging it down over people?
Oh, no, no. It's on top of the camcorder.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I've got a Panasonic DV camcorder that has an audio input, and I've got this relatively inexpensive, but it's still pretty good quality Memorex mic that I can plug into it. So
now, is that a DV camcorder?
Yes, it is.
So why don't you
wire output?
Great. Let's bring our two little camcorders, and of course, I'm going to be bringing the very expensive Canon camcorder as well that we're going to do our video work with.
Yeah,
right.
And I think we should use those. So for those out there who are thinking, well, that's a video camera. How are you going to do a audio podcast with that? I know how to do it.
Sure.
Do you know how to do it? Okay, well, then you explain it to me how we would do it for our audience guy.
Okay, well, if you wanted to use just the software that was native on your Macintosh.
Yeah, and let's stick with just something that everybody with a Macintosh is going to have.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Really, all you'd need to do is, you know, and this is assuming, of course, that your camcorder has a FireWire output,
yep.
Is once you plug the camcorder into your Mac via FireWire, it should automatically pull up iMovie. So
yep.
you bring in all of your, you know, all your stuff that you have on your camcorder into iMovie.
Which will come out as a video file, but it will probably be black because we'll leave the lens cap on the cameras.
Right.
Well, I mean, you don't even have to do that. There's a, I'll tell you what, give me just a second here. I'm going to fire up iMovie and I'll tell you exactly where the command is. You can take that raw video footage. And there's a command in iMovie where you can split it from the video and have just the track that has the audio on it.
Yeah.
And then once you've done that, you can blank out the video, save it as a QuickTime movie, and you know, once it's into QuickTime, you can convert it to AIFF or QuickTime Pro. Right.
Yes.
Right.
You got to spend the $30 for QuickTime Pro, which
It's a wise investment.
It's absolutely essential if you're doing video or audio work. You have to have QuickTime Pro. You really do.
Yeah, and it's only $30.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, it's not that big a deal.
So we would export that QuickTime movie that we created with iMovie out as an AIF file and then simply drop that into GarageBand to do the audio editing.
Yes, and I have iMovie fired up now. You go to the advanced... you know, on your top menu bar to the advanced section, and your very first command is extract audio.
Yep,
and that will put it on one of the two audio tracks that you have within iMovie.
Now, you don't necessarily have to do that anyways. You can import the entire thing, export it as a QuickTime movie.
Certainly.
Open that up and just say save as AIF file. Mm-hmm. And it will get rid of all the audio, video track as well.
Yeah, but this is assuming that if you don't actually need the video, the problem with doing it that way is that your QuickTime movie, when you first export it with the
it's going to be much bigger.
It's going to be huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're on I'm on a MacBook Pro, so that really don't. It's so fast. I don't even worry about it. And I'm not. That it's true. They are so fast that it really doesn't make much of a difference. You know, maybe a minute. And when you're talking about the size of the files that we're going to have, that's not a whole lot. So really, our recording, our podcast equipment is going to be a couple camcorders, three technically, and iMovie, QuickTime Pro, and GarageBand.
Mm-hmm. Also, I have Final Cut Express with one of my favorite apps, LiveType, and you know when we're all together, we can start playing around with that and come up with some cool stuff to put on in the beginning or even during.
Sounds like fun. So we're definitely looking to have a lot of fun and geeking out at the Macworld Expo. We're not going to be super serious on everything at the Expo. We're going to have fun.
No.
We want to bring the flavor of the show to everybody who cannot be there. Because really what we're there for is to be your eyes and ears.
Right. Yep. Minus the 500 or 600 miles that separate us at the moment.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So I'm really looking forward. I'm glad you're going to be there, Guy. I have a feeling that you and I will probably be teamed up together most of the time.
Okay.
I think that would probably work better.
Yeah, we'll just put all the packs on Larry's back.
Absolutely. He'll be our mule. Larry the mule.
Love you, Larry.
Larry the mule guy.
I did want to talk about a little bit of news here, and it's about a fellow podcaster, a good friend of the show, who actually showed up at our 100th podcast, and we've interviewed him before.
That's Rick Stringer.
And
of course, guys met Rick, so.
Yeah, Variant Variant Frequencies Podcast. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. If you're not subscribed to the Variant Frequencies Podcast, you really should.
Well, I don't like him because he has longer hair than I do.
Yeah. And he can
kick. I'm just kidding.
And he could probably. Oh, no, you take karate too. I was going to say because he
can
kick.
Well, actually, last night I received my certificate for my second degree black belt in Taekwondo.
Does that mean you're calling Rick out?
That's right. Come on, Rick. Bring it on.
You know, speaking of Rick, I actually, today was the very first time I ever did a video chat in Skype. Usually if I do a video chat, it's in iChat.
Yeah.
And in iChat, they're really nice and smooth. They look great. Mm-hmm. I did a video chat last week with Al Luckow. He's the webmaster for Steve Wozniak's website.
Yep.
And he's a famous designer. I mean, he just... He does incredible work.
Stuff. Yeah.
And we chatted on iChat for probably about 45 minutes of video chat, and in iChat never missed a beat. It was smooth the entire time. I was very happy. And that's been my experience with iChat. So I wanted to see, when I jumped on today with Skype, I saw Rick was there, and I started a video chat with Rick. And it was choppy. It looked like crap. It wasn't even close to the level of iChat and video. The audio, I think, is usually better. But in this case, and Rick said the same thing, that he was kind of disappointed in the video quality of this Skype video chat. So,
well, now, isn't it still in beta for the Mac?
I don't think so. I think it's the release version. I've got it here on Chad's computer, the latest. This is the latest, greatest version, correct, Chad?
Yeah. It's like 2.51 or something?
No, it's 2006. So, no, this is the release candidate, I believe. But even if it's not, it's. I have to say, iChat does a much, much better job
of handling video.
But going back to the Variant Frequencies podcast, one of the writers for the shows that they did is Matt Wallace, and he did a really good story.
Actually, he's done several good stories, and he writes quite a few of the stories for Variant Frequencies, including the, the Failed City Monologues, which I've been listening to faithfully since he first started writing them. And it looks like, according to his blog, he has been picked up to do a
screenplay.
Yeah.
They may turn his story into a movie.
Yep.
Which story is this?
It's the Failed City Monologues.
Is it really?
That's the one he's been doing.
Yeah, he's done several others, though, too, and I don't know which one they actually picked up. He has several really good stories, so...
You know, that's not one I get. I should I should be checking that out.
You should be checking out.
I think it's amazing news, and it says a lot about podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Here's somebody that was doing this as a podcast, and now it's going to... There's a possibility, just because someone picks up the rights to a story and has your rights, that doesn't mean a movie's actually going to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But ask Dwayne about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think this does show the power of podcasting.
Yep.
This new medium is going to cross over into other mediums, and I think it shows that this is a viable medium to get out creativity.
Yep.
So congratulations to Matt Wallace and, of course, Rick Stringer and all the gang at Variant Frequencies Podcast. I'm jazzed for them. I really am.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you guys aren't subscribed, you really should be. Go check it out. Do a search on iTunes. You'll find it. Subscribe to it and be happy.
And once you guys are rich and famous, throw a little love our way.
Yeah, the dedication on screen should be to the folks at MyMac.
Right.
Forget Rick Stringer and them guys, you know.
Yeah.
Matt doesn't even know who we are, but, you know.
Well, like that matters.
Two shows ago, we got an email from Geek Girl asking what to do with old Macs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to finish up this segment talking about what we're going to do with old Macs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our longtime listeners, Sandro, sent in some suggestions.
Oh, cool.
He called these old Macs that aren't in everyday use, but they're still plugged in and raring to go, sandbox Macs. And I think that's a great term for them. Just a sandbox Mac.
What does he mean by that?
Well, if a Mac is too old and can still run Panther or Tiger, you can use it to run or to test out the new software or the OS updates you like to try, but you might be a little nervous about running them on your day-to-day production machine, which is excellent.
Yeah.
You know, there's one problem with that. The older machine might not have a problem with a piece of software or an update, whereas the new machine might.
Mm.
So unless they're like mirrors of each other, you can't really tell.
Right. Yeah. Well, for the most part, I would agree with that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's still a nice little idea to use that old Mac for, providing you have a lot of desk space to have multiple Macs going.
Yeah, well, another way you could probably do that, I know we're kind of going off, or I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, is you could have an external drive that you've mirrored your operating system, or actually just your main drive to, and boot up via that in not target mode. You can boot up from any any FireWire device that has a valid OS on it, and run the OS update on that and see how it works.
Yeah, I do that. I used to. I kind of take my chance. Of course, I don't upgrade anything usually the first day. I let it usually go, hopefully a week, but sometimes a couple days before I update. And I check out the message boards and the websites, and I find out what's the major issues. Is it interfering with programs that I use on a daily basis? And if it is, I'll just kind of hold off for a while. And I do like in Sandro's email, he writes, as an aside, a good use for a Windows PC, and for some laughs, turn it into what is known as a honeypot. If you configure your network correctly, you can expose the PC to the internet without any protection from firewalls and antivirus software. Sit back and watch what happens, and how fast it happens. When your honeypot PC attracts all the crap that's out there, makes you appreciate your Mac even more.
and this is without you this is without you even doing anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He says another great use for old Macs that run OS X is to use them as learning platforms for network operations or for Unix or any other kind of programming. A lot of times when you read articles on running handy little procedures using the terminal, you see warnings about how potentially dangerous certain commands can be. Well, now you can boldly type into your Unix commands into a terminal, knowing that if you do something devastating, heck, you can always, you know, go back to the way it was. It's just a sandbox machine.
Yep.
You can wipe it and start over. It's not a big deal. I think those are some really great ideas. Of course, he also kicks out the, you could turn it into a Mac aquarium or a flower pot. you know.
Or just set it up as your, like what Larry actually did. He went out and bought a... I think it was a G4 Mac Mini, and he uses that for his like audio and video storage. And
oh, that's a good
idea.
It's
on the network, so he pulls it off of that and puts it on his regular TV.
Well, I've got a couple different Macs, and one of them I'm probably about ready to retire, the dual processor G4 Tower, 500 megahertz.
Isn't that like a 533?
It's a 500 megahertz.
Okay.
And so it's the original dual processor G4. It's not the mirror doors. It looks like the original G4s.
Yep.
Now, I've got three drives in that machine, and none of them are really large. And the only thing I really use it for that I have been using it for is backup. It's storing some older files mm-hmm. that I don't have anywhere else. I was using it as my iPhoto library, but man, you know, it's got a lot of photos on there,
mm-hmm.
and it just takes forever for iPhoto to open on that old machine. So I'm thinking about everything that's on those hard drives on that G4, simply copying over to a FireWire external FireWire hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And wiping the G4 completely and just getting rid of it.
Yeah.
I boot it up maybe every 6 weeks, if that.
Mm.
And I'm having a problem right now. I boot it up and I can't see it on the network. Mm. I don't have a monitor plugged into it or even a keyboard or a mouse.
Yeah.
I Timbuktu into it. Mm. So there's some problem and I have to hook up a monitor and it just seems like a whole big rigmarole for me to go through all that.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be retired. The mm-hmm. other machine that I use a lot or that I don't use a lot that's just sitting there is the Mac Mini. Now, this mm-hmm. is the G4 flavor Mac Mini.
Right.
That is my new, I guess you would say, iPhoto storage. So I'll load that up on the network and just copy my entire iPhoto library over to it, overwriting the existing one, mm-hmm. so it has the latest and greatest pictures, including all my old ones.
Right.
And it works great for that because it's actually faster than my desktop G4.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's 1 gigahertz in speed.
Yeah.
And it's connected wirelessly, so... that is hooked up to a monitor and keyboard, but I never turn either one on. So.
Mm.
so that's what I do. And the other two machines, my production G5, which is, what is that, 2.5 gigahertz
dual processor.
Yeah. And then the MacBook Pro, which I actually probably use the MacBook Pro more than anything else. I'm this mm-hmm. close from going to a laptop full-time.
Yeah.
The only problem is screen size. Mm. So I'd have to plug in the 23-inch monitor all the time.
Yeah.
And I like...
Does that machine have the 128 or the 256 card?
256, so...
Ooh, sweet.
Yeah. But, mm-hmm. you know, as fast as the MacBook Pro is, it really isn't as fast as my desktop machine. And I'm much more... I can use a trackpad as well as anybody, but I'm so much faster with a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Just so much faster, so...
I like trackballs myself.
Yeah, I could never get into the trackball.
I can't either. It's, to me, I'm... The whole wrist to motion thing is so counterintuitive. You're using a mouse so often. So
A lot of people say, well, I use a trackball because I have carpal tunnel.
Yeah.
Or when I use a rollerball, a trackpad, that's when I can feel carpal tunnel starting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Using a mouse, I have no problem. And I've been using a mouse for 15 years now,
mm-hmm.
almost on a daily basis. And I have more problems with the trackpad. The trackball.
Yeah.
So there are some suggestions from Sandro. Thanks a lot, Sandro. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys given any thought to what to do with those old Macs yourselves? Any ideas?
Well, I kind of like what John Farr did with his in the faster Mac in the world part 3.
Part 3, yeah.
Those were some great blogs.
Yes.
Absolutely. If you don't know what we're talking about, go up to mymac.com and look at the latest postings from John Farr. The fastest Mac in the world part 1. Two and three. And that is on the blog side, the right-hand side of the webpage. Go ahead, Chad.
And that is a great suggestion. Some of the things you can do with some of your older Macs is donate them to somebody who needs it.
Yeah. It's amazing because, how many times you'll find someone that could use that old Mac.
Yeah.
Well, I actually did something like that. My kids had it was an iMac 400 DV, and I had gotten a refurbed 17-inch. I think it's a 1.8 G5 iMac, and it was the old 400 DV was just kind of collecting dust. And I have a nephew who lives down in Fort Lauderdale, who had a 266
Ouch.
iMac.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the power supply had gone, so it was a dead horse. And I had this 400 megahertz machine just kind of sitting there. So, you know, I got it out, and I wiped the drive. I loaded it up with 10.3 and updated it to 10.3.9 and found a bunch of, you know, freeware and shareware apps that he would enjoy on it. He's, I think he's 16 now.
And 10.3.9 is the highest you can take those older iMacs. The G3 iMacs cannot run Tiger. So 10.3.9 is the highest you're going to take those Macs.
Are you sure about that?
Yep. Unfortunately. Okay. Maybe some of the very later G3 iMacs may be able to run Tiger, but I know the first couple generations of iMacs cannot.
I thought all you needed was a FireWire and a DVD drive.
You might be correct. I'm under the impression it's been so long; those machines are so old now that it's hard to remember that I haven't had to deal with that in a long time.
Yeah,
you might be right. But, you know, putting Tiger on such an old machine probably is not the best idea anyways.
Yeah, it would be pretty slow.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But I, you know, the other thing I did, because it only had, I think it had like a 13 gig drive. So I went out to the store and I got a, they were relatively cheap. It was an ATA, I think it was a 120 gig drive that I slapped in there for him. And I shipped it down to him. The only thing I asked from his parents was to pay for shipping.
Sure. Which is probably, $40?
No, it was like $75 with insurance and everything else.
Well, that's a pretty heavy machine, though.
Yeah. It was like, I think it's close to 40 pounds. It's, you know, it's not light.
But for a 16-year-old to get a nice machine that's got everything that he's probably going to need, at least initially.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and his dad, who's like, you know, Dell all the way, was trying to talk him into getting a regular PC. And he was like, no, Uncle Guy, I really, really like Macs because... I'd gone down there the first time in a long time once they moved from Virginia down to Florida, and I had an old Pismo 500 PowerBook.
Yep.
And I was, you know, he had his 230 or his 266 megahertz iMac, and I was showing him, you know, iMovie and some of the other stuff that the Pismo was able to do with a, you know, twice as fast of a processor, and he was just like, amazed. So he didn't want to go PC. He's always used a Mac, and that's what he wanted.
I was talking to John Farr on the telephone yesterday, talking about a new project that's going to be coming up at mymac.com in probably January, possibly February, if things don't move as quickly as we hope they will be. And I don't want to give too much out of the bag, or let too much out of the bag, I should say. But I will say it has to do with ebooks. Yes, the mymac.com ebooks are coming back. We learned a lot from the mistakes that we made the first time around. But regardless, I was talking to John, and I said, you know, the first person who could come up with a very lucrative solution for older computers to put them to use will be a very rich person. Mm-hmm. Because I think that this is a problem, what to do with these old machines. They still work.
Right.
They're still as viable now as they ever were.
Sure.
With the technology that they're capable of handling. Why should they go into a landfill? You know, they got this big project now, the $100 laptop for the developing world. Mm-hmm. Well, how about making a $100 generator and they can use these older machines that will have a lot more capability than some cheap $100 laptop that doesn't even have a real OS on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very basic. Yeah. You know, I think that would be, give them a $100 generator that can run a few different computers. I think that's more valuable than these other projects. I think that's a great idea. Of course,
you had the that $100 laptop project going on too. And
no, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, those are supposed to have like a crank on them so that you can kind of generate your own power with them.
I know, but my point is, how about making a generator using that type of technology so you can generate your own electricity that can power an older PC that would have more capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use this generator for other things other than a freaking laptop.
Shades of Gilligan's Island.
Well, it's a real problem in the third world.
Mm-hmm. Tell me.
If you can give them cheap generators, imagine what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things we take for granted.
Right.
You know, having running water, or clean water that's not brown in color when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forget this little laptop. I like the idea. I like the idea behind it, the concept. But you know what? Let's give them generators. How about that? Mm-hmm. We can give them used PCs that have a lot more capabilities.
Yep.
You know, and really get them on the information superhighway instead mm-hmm. of these cheap laptops that, oh, it's got a little hand crank on it, so I can, you know, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Give them something they can really use, which is a generator.
Yeah. And having been to a lot of these third world countries, I can verify that, you know, you can't drink the water. You know, in some of the places I went to, whether or not I was actually going to get 2 to 3 meals a day could be iffy. And, you know, I'm staying at the very best places, and they're flea bags.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's our segment this week. We definitely welcome your feedback. You can send all email to mymacpodcast@gmail.com. And we do have a phone number if you want to have your voice in on the conversation.
And our Skype in line is 1-801-938-5559.
And you can call that from any telephone anywhere in the entire world.
Yes.
Well, unless you're in a third world country with a hand crank.
That's right. Then you're out of luck, I guess.
Yes, but, I will.
They're probably not listening to the podcast anyways.
Mm. Yeah, we need iPods with cranks.
There you go. There's an idea.
Cranky pods.
That's already a show, I think, though.
Yeah.
That's a show.
That's Cranky Geeks.
So we will be back next week. I don't believe we have any interviews lined up for next week, do we?
No, we don't.
So it's just going to be the three of us. We'll have a new topic next week, which at the moment we have no idea what it's going to be. Hopefully we can share your ideas, your thoughts, your emails, mm-hmm. and maybe your voice messages, and we can reply to them. If you're looking for help with your Mac, we can help you with there. Tom, our own Tom Schmidt at mymac.com.
Yep.
He's certified Apple. Well, we know he's certified, but...
Yeah. He's an Apple certified.
He's Apple certifiable. And he's looking for questions to answer, and if you have questions for him, we'll be happy to forward them on.
Yep.
So we will see. We'll be back next week, and let's get on with the show.
Hello, my name is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. This time, I'm going to talk about some of the developments that have been occurring in virtual machine technology on the Mac platform over the last few weeks. As you may recall from earlier fenestrations, I announced that VMware, who are the big movers in virtualization technology in the Windows space, have been looking to develop a Macintosh version of their software. This has gone into private beta over the last few weeks. Now, I did apply to be on the private beta program, but unfortunately I have yet to receive my copy of their product, which is currently termed VMware Fusion. One thing I have heard is that the performance of the product is not quite as good as Parallels. Now, Parallels is the Macintosh homegrown, if you like, version of VMware technology. They're a Canadian company that came out of nowhere, really, and surprised everyone with the launch of their Parallels product, which even when it was in beta was very, very strongly performing and had a lot of good features. Now, one of the advantages of Parallels over any other product, including Microsoft's Virtual PC, older PowerPC platform, is their interaction with their users and their responsiveness in terms of developing the product, fixing bugs, and bringing in new features. This is very much typified, in my view, by their latest beta release. Now, the release version of the product is currently at version 1970, but what they've done is they've released the beta at 3036 as the version number, which indicates how far they've been developing the product while the public version has been available. The feature list of this thing is quite incredible, and having installed and run the beta on my MacBook, I'm really impressed with it because so many of these features are really quite mature. First of all, they've improved the look and feel of the application. It always seemed a little bit cobbled together before, but they've really actually beefed that up, and it now does look very much like a genuine OS X application. They've now got a virtual machines catalogue. This means that every time you load the product up, it lists all the virtual machines you've got available. In the past, it didn't do this, and so you might create a virtual machine and then forget about it, or forget that you finished creating it. Now you always see all the virtual machines that are installed. It now allows you to create virtual machine aliases, which can be put on the desktop. You can double-click on one of these aliases, and it will fire them a virtual machine straight up. If it's suspended, it will bring it back to life. If it's not running, it will actually run it straight away. So that's a nice, convenient feature for getting straight to your virtual machines. The Parallels window, when you've got a Windows desktop running, is now resizable. And what it will do is it will automatically adjust the Windows screen resolution as you resize that window. This effectively means that you can have a Windows desktop at whatever size you want, and you can adjust it on the fly without having to go into display properties on the Windows side. This is a really nice feature because it means you can shrink something right down, make it quite small, so it'll fit on one side of your widescreen monitor, and you won't have to start scrolling around within the Parallels window to actually see the whole of the Windows desktop. They've brought something over which VMware has had for a long time, and also Virtual PC, and really is a very, very nice feature, and that is drag and drop. In the past with Parallels, if you wanted to transfer files between your OS X environment and your Windows Parallels environment, what you had to do was set up shared networking. Now, they gave you a tool to do this using shared folders, but effectively what it meant you had to do was you had to drop files that you wanted to transfer to Windows into a particular folder, and then go into the Windows side and work on them from there, and vice versa. You don't need to do that anymore, because with drag and drop, you can literally pick up a file from any Finder window and just drag it and drop it onto the Windows environment, and it's automatically copied to whatever's showing in that Windows environment. This is a really nice feature. It does mean you don't need to bother with shared networking or shared folders anymore, and it works really well in the beta. Now, the big one. What they've done is they've introduced integration with any bootcamp partitions you've got on your drive. What this means is that if you have bootcamp installed, say you've given it 10 gig of your drive for a bootcamp installation, you've installed Windows, you've installed Office, you've installed whatever you want to run. Now what Parallels can do is, provided you install one extra tool into that bootcamp partition, it can then access that bootcamp partition and run Windows from it. So then this means you don't need to create a separate virtual machine hard drive that runs Windows. You can use the bootcamp partition. It saves you a lot of disk space, and it means you don't have to have multiple copies of Windows on your machine. Now, the word is, and I've not tested it myself because I don't run bootcamp on my machine, but the word is that this actually works very well, with one caveat. The caveat is that what's happening is that Windows XP is seeing the change of environment from bootcamp, where it can see all the actual physical hardware on your Mac. And then when you run it in Parallels, it sees different hardware, because obviously Parallels presents the hardware in a different way. It doesn't have 3D support, for example. It virtualizes what's happening on the machine because the machine's running OS X at the same time. The problem is XP is seeing that and thinking it's been copied to a different machine and is trying to reactivate itself. If you then go back to bootcamp, it sees a change again and also is coming up with a reactivation dialogue. Now, it's hard to know whether this is truly Parallels' problem or whether it's just a flaw in the way that Microsoft sees things and sees changes on the machine. But at the moment, it is a bit of a problem. As I've said, the software's only in beta, so I'm sure Parallels will be working on it. But as it stands at the moment, while the feature does work and it is a very nice idea, problems in the implementation mean that it's not something you can use as a working environment today. But it's nice that they're thinking about that. As far as I'm aware, it's not something that VMware are looking to do. So they are really looking to try and compete with VMware and to bring in features that people are going to want to use. The other thing I would say about Bootcamp, as I alluded to a moment ago, is obviously you don't have full access to the machine's hardware. So what this is not is a route to play games under Parallels. Because while the games you'll be able to access the games installation in a bootcamp partition, no problem, you won't have 3D graphics support when you're running bootcamp via Parallels, because Parallels in the current build does not present 3D graphics support in the hardware drivers. So you will have to boot back into bootcamp if you want to play games from your bootcamp partition. Having said that, what they have done with this build of Parallels is they have increased performance across the board. The graphics performance certainly seems a lot snappier, and the general system performance seems to be perceptibly quicker than it was on build 1970, which was the build I was using before. Everything seems to work in a much nicer manner, and I'm much happier with the performance. Not that I was unhappy with the performance of 1970, but the fact is any free performance gains just from a software upgrade, in my view, is a good thing. There's a whole load of behind-the-scenes performance improvements as well. One of the problems people have had with Parallels is that the USB support has not been as good as you might hope. That has been improved. I can certainly concur with that. I'm able to synchronize my BlackBerry with a Windows version of the BlackBerry management software under build 3036. I wasn't able to do that before, so USB support is certainly stronger. They've improved the networking support. It now allows multiple network cards at the same time, which, if you're running server versions of an operating system under Parallels, is something that will be helpful. They also now allow you to change networking modes on the fly. In the past, you had to stop and restart the virtual machine every time you wanted to change networking mode. You don't need to do that anymore. It now reconfigures on the fly. Some other usability improvements are they've improved the keyboard mapping, so you can now use Apple keyboard shortcuts for copy and paste inside the Parallels environment. This is a nice little add-on, because in the past what you had to do is remember that when you were in Windows you had to use Control-C and Control-V for copy and paste. And when you're in the, obviously in the OS X environment, you use Apple-C and Apple-V, or Command-C and Command-V. Now the problem with that was that one of the things Parallels allows you to do is to copy and paste between the Windows environment and the Parallels environment. Obviously that's a useful thing to be able to do. So if you select a block of text in the Windows environment, you had to do Control-C to copy it, and then go over to your word processor in your Mac environment and remember to do Apple-V rather than Control-V to paste it in. Now you don't need to do that. You can use the Apple Windows shortcuts within the Windows environment and the Parallels environment thanks to the enhanced keyboard mapping. So that's a nice usability feature. One other thing which is still to be developed, but I think is a really big usability feature, is something that Parallels are terming coherence. Now, what coherence does is really, it's a clever trick. What it does is, when you're in an application, you've got it opened in a Windows environment on your desktop, and you've got the Windows desktop behind the application. What you can do is click the coherence button or hit the coherence shortcut. And what Parallels does is it effectively masks away the entire Windows environment except for the application you're using. So that means that the application could be the Windows version of Office, say the Windows version of Word. I use this a lot with Lotus Notes, actually, so I'd run the Windows version of Lotus Notes for our mail clients at work. What happens is that mail client, or that copy of Office or whatever, then becomes a full part of your OS X environment in its own window, because all of the Windows stuff that's still running in the background within Parallels is hidden from you. Now, you can resize that window, you can drag it around your desktop, you can drag it to multiple monitors, whichever one way you want to do it. Now, it's not completely seamless, because it doesn't appear as its own icon in your dock, and if you minimize it, then you have to bring back the entire Windows desktop to actually bring it back up and change application. What it also doesn't do is it doesn't work with multiple applications at the same time. So if you've got the Windows version of Word and Excel open at the same time, if you went to coherence mode, you wouldn't see those as two separate windows. You'd only ever see whatever the active one was. So it's a little bit of a trick, because what it's doing is it's just masking away things that you can't see in the background. But it does mean that the integration of a Windows application into your OS X environment becomes much more seamless than it was before. Now, obviously, in the last podcast I did, in Fenestration 17, I was talking about using virtual desktops to get a similar sort of effect. Now you don't need to use virtual desktops. You can use this coherence mode. And providing you're not doing a lot of Windows application switching, it works really well. In short, if you're a Parallels user, I highly recommend you drop over to Parallels.com and have a look at the new beta. It's really an impressive piece of software, and really shows that Parallels, despite being a much smaller company than VMware, are really interested in looking to take their share of the market to VMware and show that they can compete on an equal footing. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
One of the highlights of attending the Macworld Expo in San Francisco every January is getting to meet the authors whose books we get to review during the year. And we've gotten to know Mikkel Åland. Beg your pardon, that's Mikkel Åland. It's pronounced Åland, but it's spelled A-A-L-A-N-D. And we're about to meet him as we discuss Photoshop CS2 Raw by O'Reilly Media. Price $35 US, Canada $49. Here's the interview. Welcome, Mikkel Åland, and is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
I'm really impressed. It goes to show that we are old friends, that you're pronouncing my name right, John.
Absolutely. Well, the book we're talking about is Photoshop CS2 Raw, published by O'Reilly. And how much processor speed and memory for optimum use of RAW using Adobe Photoshop CS2 on the Macintosh?
You know, I got to be really honest with you, John. Nowadays, with just about any Mac that's out there, you're going to be fine using that system to process your RAW images. We're way up to speed now with all the systems, and that should not be any limiting factor in terms of shooting or using RAW.
That's very good news. Well, the first thing you talk about in your book, Photoshop CS2 RAW, is the bridge. And most people are just kind of confused about the bridge. So very briefly, what are the strengths and weaknesses of using Photoshop CS2's bridge to handle the first stage of managing RAW photos into CS2?
Good question. I just want to back up for 1 second and just explain what I mean when I talk about a system here now, because we're not just using Photoshop, the classic Photoshop environment that we all know. We actually have three environments now we're working in, and we're working in Photoshop, Bridge, and Camera Raw, and they all work together. And as you said, in the Bridge application, this is where everything starts. This is the, I call it the browser on steroids, because you have many more options than you used to have with the old browser. You can organize your images and catalog them, sort them, and then it becomes the gateway that takes you into Camera Raw and then Photoshop.
Okie dokie. But do professional and serious amateurs need to be systematic and detail-oriented to work successfully with Bridge and RAW and all this other stuff that they've never even heard of before?
Good question again. Again, this is one of the beauties of the app, and one of the pitfalls of the application as well. Photoshop CS2 will take you just about anywhere you want to go, and that there's so many different levels that you can approach it. And the beauty is you can approach it from a fairly simplistic, straightforward way. If you want to build in complexity, you can also do that. And I'm talking about in terms of organizing let's say, keywording and going to greater level in managing your images. You can do that, but you can keep it fairly simple, a file folder hierarchy based on dates, maybe very much what you already have. So it's up to you how complicated you want to make your system.
But do you think that photographers need to be technically proficient on computers? I mean, for most serious photographers, isn't this a huge waste of productivity and billable time if they're a pro?
Well, if you're a pro, this is what you do. You make good images, and to get the best images, you need to be shooting RAW now. And there's just that's, I guess what you can call a line of difference between you and an amateur. So if it takes a little bit more work to get where you're going, I think as a professional, you're obligated to do that. Having said that, there are many ways, and this is why I wrote the book, there are many ways you can use automated systems to get you where you want to go. There's scripts, for example, that are already built in that will automatically do a lot of the conversion from RAW into JPEG or TIFF or whatever file format you want. So there are ways of automating the process once you set it up, and that will speed it up, so it won't take all day to process a shoot of RAW images, for example.
Terrific. How many minutes or hours typically do you, Mikkel, personally spend enhancing and editing pictures in RAW now?
Well, it really depends on what I'm trying to do. I mean, there are some things where I have a shoot where I have several hundred images where I need to sort through them, rate them, bring it down to, let's say, a handful or a dozen of images that go off to a photo editor. So in that case, then it's just a selection process. It goes fairly quickly. And then the conversion is done pretty much with a script. So I can get a shoot out the door pretty quickly, 45 minutes, half an hour, and in an editor's hand using the Camera Raw Bridge Photoshop system.
Well, let's remind our listeners and readers that the publisher is O'Reilly. The cost in the U.S. is $35. It's $49 in Canada. The title is Photoshop CS2 Raw. The author is Mikkel Oland. And the production values on this book are really quite extraordinary because you've got bazillions of screenshots and diagrams and charts and sidebars. I mean, the book itself is really quite wonderful, and I know you thank your production team. Could you just tell us briefly what makes this book special as an author and from a publishing point of view?
Well, John, you know, I've done many books, and I've been working for years trying to come up with a format that really gets people up to speed and illuminates and doesn't intimidate. I really believe in that strongly, and I'm so thrilled this time around to work with a design that allowed me to really couple the text and the screenshots or images in a way that basically they go in tandem. So you're reading along, and right to your right constantly is a visual reinforcement of the text. And I'm thrilled to have come up with this format. I'm using it for some other books I'm working on now, and I've gotten nothing but positive response on it because I'm actually trying to talk to people who are very visual. And, you know, visual people like visual cues. So we're really trying to build books that are nice balance between the narrative or the word and then the image. It does take a lot more work from a production point of view. There's no question.
Well, I think you've succeeded. And I am going to tell you live for all the world to hear that My Mac Book Bites Live awards you our highest 5 out of 5 rating for this title, Photoshop CS2 Raw. And that doesn't come with any box of chocolates or blue ribbons, but it means that our readers and listeners will know that this book gets our highest possible recommendation.
John, thank you so much. And that the bottle of virtual champagne that's showing up on my screen, that's a really nice touch.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you in a few weeks at Macworld. And until then, I hope your book sells 500,000 between now and the beginning of January.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you, always.
Appreciate it, Mikkel.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig here with a Speedy Review gift guide. I've got 3 great gift ideas for the gadgety people in your life, and all these gift gadgets are under $100. The first of the 3 gadgets I'd like to talk to you about is the Twist Ball by a company called PWX. I have the Platinum Twist Ball. Now, the Twist Balls range in price from about $10 to $20, depending on what color or which mounting mechanism you want to purchase. And what the Twist Ball is, are 2 little semicircular spheres that you stick on the bottom of your laptop just to give it a little bit of a lift on one end. This gadget is great for somebody who has a laptop that does a lot of work on a desk and needs to angle the screen just a little bit and tilt that keyboard up so it's easier to use. I put mine on my iBook and found it to be very comfortable. Remember, they range in price between $10 and $20. You want to go to www.postworks, and that's postworx.com, to find out which option is right for you. Okay, next up is the Logitech New Look, and that is spelled rather funny. It's spelled N-U-L-O-O-Q. The New Look is for that Photoshop user in your life or the heavy CS2 user in your life. At first look, the New Look looks like it might be some sort of mouse. Well, it's not really a mouse, but they claim it's your mouse best friend. It's a USB device. It's a little bit smaller than a mouse, and it's heavily weighted because you don't actually move this device around. It actually just sits stationary on your tabletop next to your keyboard. It is an input device just like your mouse, but it has a whole bunch of preset shortcuts that work specifically with CS2 applications like Photoshop. They also work with some other applications too, but I wanted to use this as a pro tool to try and help my workflow. So why do you need another mouse? Well, What's cool about this is it's got a twist mechanism in the center, and the twist mechanism allows you to quickly zoom in and out of your Photoshop documents or your InDesign documents. It also has 5 buttons on the top, 3 of which are programmable, and 2 that are specifically designed for shortcuts in Photoshop, so you can quickly adjust your brush sizes, your pressure sizes, and more. At the very top of the device, amidst the 5 buttons, is also a touch sensor, which has precision control that allows you to quickly and easily make your tool adjustments. Now, the new look sells for $80, and I highly recommend you go over to Logitech.com, search for new look, and watch some of the video clips that they have up here, so you can see exactly what I'm trying to explain, which isn't all that easy to do on an audio podcast. Finally today, I would like to talk to you about iMaingo. That's lowercase I, M-A-I-N-G-O. And you can find them at iMaingo.com. iMaingo is quite honestly the best pair of speakers that I've tested this year that retail for under $150. Wait, I don't know if I need to rephrase that, because these speakers don't sell for $150. They sell for $55. And they sound better than all of the speakers that I've tested this year that cost as much as $150. But wait, there's more. The iMaingo are powered by 4 AAA batteries, and the speaker system is so small it fits in the palm of your hands. That's what makes this such an amazing gadget for $55. But wait, there's more. The iMaingo also is a case for your iPod. The iMaingo is a zipper pouch compartment that its dimensions are 4 inches by 2.5 inches by 6 inches. The iMaingo will work with any iPod. It's got a bunch of little sleeves that will allow you to adjust the fitting so everything fits nice and snug inside the pouch. The iPod connects on the top with the mini headphone jacks. And on the front of the unit, there's actually a plastic shield which allows you to navigate the menus and adjust the volume on the iPod. The only issue I found with the speaker system is extremely minute, and that is that the power switch is on the inside of the zipper compartment. So when I want to power down the speakers, I have to open it up and turn the speaker system on and off from the inside. So there you have it, the Speedy Review Holiday Gift Guide. As always, I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Happy holidays, everyone.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to mymacpodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the mymac.com podcast.